This is Fresh Air. Los Angeles isn't what you think it is. You think it's the capital of the entertainment industry, which it is. But it has also become the capital of the third world. At least that's what David Reif concludes in his new book, Los Angeles. Of course, a lot of Angelenos might say, what does he know? He's from New York. But he did spend half of the past 3 years in L.A., and he spent part of his childhood there, too. Reif is the son of Susan Sontag. He's written for many magazines and is the author of a previous book in which he sized up Miami. When he told his New York friends he was going to L.A., they assumed he was writing a movie script or researching yet another book about Hollywood. But that's Reif's point. It's time to bring those clichés up to date. Los Angeles has been changed by a wave of immigration. And that's why he titled his book, Los Angeles, Capital of the Third World.
I mean, something maybe a little less inflammatory than that title suggests to some people. I think that, if you like, the history of the United States can be usefully described in terms of its immigrations. If you think that there was one kind of United States when the country was made up of the Native Americans who were here first, the white settlers and African slaves. And then that country was pretty much entirely transformed between the end of the Civil War and the end of the First World War by a wave of immigration from northeastern and southeastern Europe, from Poland, from Russia, from Italy. And I think what's happening now is that as this great third wave of immigration from Latin America and from East Asia begins to reverberate in the country, that the country's again being transformed. I think that the place where that is most obvious is Los Angeles, maybe because it always prided itself on being the most American, which frankly, when people in L.A. in the 1920s used that phrase, they really meant white. It was a sort of racist euphemism. But it was the city that was supposed to sum up the kind of blonde ideal of America, at least as white Americans construed it. And now it's a city which is most notable for being a great immigrant city, a city, moreover, not of immigrants from Europe, although there are plenty of those, particularly Russian Jews and some people from Western Europe who work in the movie business. But in terms of real numbers, people from Mexico and El Salvador and the Philippines and South Korea and Taiwan and Hong Kong. And those are the people who are transforming the city.
Los Angeles has always been home to many Mexicans and Mexican-Americans. Why is Los Angeles now becoming a home for so many people who are immigrating from Latin America and from the Pacific Rim?
Well, in part because it is like New York, the closest spot or the closest major spot. The East Asian immigrants, many of whom come with money, one of the more meretricious things that people say when they compare Hispanic immigrants to Asian immigrants is, and they talk about Asian immigrants doing so much better, one of the things they always forget is that a lot of Asian immigrants come from the middle class and come with some financial resources, which is certainly not true of people coming north these days from El Salvador. But I think L.A. is a great magnet. It's also the great, it has been for the last 20 years, this extraordinary boomtown.
So how much interaction do you think there is between the entertainment industry part of Los Angeles and the part of Los Angeles that's populated by recently arrived immigrants?
Well, I think very little. I think there is, in a city like New York or Boston or Philadelphia or Chicago, cities which have a kind of vertical core, you rub up against everybody else who lives there. But in cities, that's because, of course, you're walking around. You have at least some occasion, even if you're driving into the from the suburbs to walk to. You go into your office but then you go downstairs and you'll walk to lunch. In L.A., as in all of the more modern Sunbelt cities, you drive everywhere. I mean, there are only a few places in Los Angeles where anyone would have any occasion to walk. So life, almost by definition, is more sequestered. I mean, the old cliché, which is never really true, but obviously had some truth in it, of L.A. being a city of, not so much a city, but 100 suburbs, continues to this day. If you live in on the far west side of Los Angeles and say you have an office downtown, what you do is you leave your house, you get into your car, you drive downtown, you put it in a lot, you're in your elevator, you go back in your car, you go back home. You would never notice, for example, or you might never notice unless you were paying attention, that that whole neighborhood has become Korean in the last 10 years.
My guest is David Reif, author of the new book Los Angeles, Capital of the Third World. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Reif, and he's written a new book called Los Angeles, Capital of the Third World. Most of the friends who you visited in Los Angeles lived in West L.A., right?
Yes.
And that's how would you describe West L.A.?
I call it the Pleasure Dome. I think it is, you know, a part of the city, and for that matter, a part of the country where the living is genuinely easy. I mean, in objective terms, if you didn't care about anything else but creature comforts, I can really think of very few places, if you had the money to be able to afford life there, more pleasant to live in than West Los Angeles. It's, of course, the place where the people in the entertainment business, which is the most visible part of L.A. to the rest of the world, live. It's also where the hotels are, where the good restaurants are. And it's Beverly Hills, it's West Hollywood, it's Santa Monica. It's all the places that you would see, for example, in the L.A. as portrayed in a movie like Steve Martin's L.A. Story. But what I discovered as I started to spend time there was that this city within a city, this pleasure dome, is maintained by the sweat of immigrant labor. That is, L.A., for example, is a desert. It shouldn't be green, and yet there are very few places greener than West L.A. Well, they're greener because there are all these gardeners from El Salvador who come every morning and do the work and then sort of disappear. And there, people, if you go into any kitchen in a prosperous part of West L.A., there is very likely to be a Salvadoran maid cleaning up. Those are the real life, that sort of beyond the appearances.
Do you think it's a corrupting influence for white middle-class people to be employing the services of newly arrived immigrants and relying on them to cook and clean and so on? Do you think it's like mutually beneficial or corrupting?
I think it's both. I think it's obviously mutually beneficial in the sense that one mustn't treat the immigrants like missionaries treated people from many of the same parts of the world 100 years ago. People from L.A., these are grown-up people who've decided that it's better to live in Los Angeles being a maid than living in El Salvador or the Philippines. So, and white middle-class people have a better life from these maids. So in that sense, I think it probably is mutually beneficial. But I'm principally interested in describing things. But what I do want to point out, and one of the points that I make in this book, is that it's also, I don't know about corrupting, but de-democratizing. You now have a situation in which one group of people live by one set of rules and another group of people by another. And I just want people to think about whether they want that.
What do you mean?
Well, I think that people imagine lazily that the maids of today will be the attorneys of tomorrow. And I don't see any reason why that should be true. It's a different kind of economy than the one that existed when the immigrants came from Europe in 1900. Things are much more expensive today. There are all kinds of reasons why you could think that immigration won't work out the same way this time around as it did 100 years ago. So maybe we're going to live with a permanent class of maids. And I just think that that is a de-democratizing situation. It's also just a very different way of life if you're used to the idea that if you leave the dishes in the sink, the maid will deal with them, than it is if you think you have to do it yourself.
I have to ask you, don't you really hate it when an outsider comes to your city, New York, and writes a book about what New York really means?
I think that's what a travel writer does. You go somewhere else and you observe. As Joan Didion once said, don't trust the writer. She's always selling somebody out. And I think there's truth in that. But I just assume that someone wanted to come and write about New York, where I've lived for the last 20 years on and off, that would be okay with me.
Would you want to move to Los Angeles?
Oh, I love Los Angeles. I certainly intend to spend part of every year there from now on.
Your mother is Susan Sontag, the writer. And I was wondering if when you were growing up, if your friends knew her work at all, knew her reputation, and if that meant anything.
Well, I was very conscious of being a writer's son. In some ways, being a second-generation writer, it's a bit like the family olive oil business. Maybe it was overdetermined that I become a writer. Sure. I mean, my friends, many of them also came from literary and artistic families. So we were the children of these writers and painters and the like in New York in the 60s. I think by and large it was in professional terms a great help to have a well-known writer as a parent.
How did it help?
Well, because it wasn't mysterious. You know, I teach these days writing in workshops in the summer. And one of the things that I always discover when I teach sometimes very, very talented people is that they don't know the first thing about the sort of practical side of the writer's life. And I grew up just taking that for granted. And I think you save a lot of time that way.
Your mother's books are very challenging to read. I mean, they have pretty, you know, complicated ideas expressed in them. Did you read her stuff when you were young?
I did, actually. Listen, I have to tell you that I was a kind of bookworm kid, and I read my mother's work and the work of a lot of other people from a preposterously young age. I mean, again, you could, if you wanted to speak in kind of psychological terms, you could say it was all horribly overdetermined. But the fact of the matter is I was reading a lot of hard books from, you know, early adolescence on.
Someone who didn't know you wouldn't necessarily guess that you were the son of Susan Sontag, since you have your father's last name, which is Reif. And I'm wondering if that has ever seemed like an advantage or disadvantage to you, you know, having a different name.
Well, I think by and large it was probably an advantage, because in the sense I could do my own work without the whole substance of people's reaction to it coming from the fact that I'm Susan Sontag's son. I think I mean, all that happened was that I used that name forever, and I didn't, although I have my mother's name as a middle name, but I've never used it in work. I was in publishing for 12 years. I never used it, and it seemed pretty pretentious to start using it once I started to publish a lot.
David Reif, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
David Reif's new book is Los Angeles, Capital of the Third World. This is Fresh Air.